This is the Wealthability for CPAs show. Better clients, better practice, better life. Here's Tom Wheelwright.
Welcome to the Wealthability show for CPAs, where we're always discovering how to build better clients, a better practice, and a better life. Hi, this is Tom Wheelwright, your host, founder, and CEO of the Wealthability Network. So lots of changes in the tax law for 2023. And I noticed an opinion written by the Tax Foundation. I thought we'd get the Tax Foundation on the line here. And we have our good friend, Garrett Watson, to discuss the upcoming changes for 2023 in the tax law, and particularly how those affect the smaller businesses. So Garrett, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Garrett, what do you see as the maybe top three tax changes for 2023?
Yeah, so as we're seeing coming into 2023, there's a lot of discussion late last year, particularly at the federal level, about a lot of the tax changes that were going to happen that they were trying to reverse or fix that do come into effect. They're going to affect folks this year and, of course, going into their tax return at the beginning of next year. The biggest ones, particularly on the business side, that are worth mentioning, a lot of them, of course, are a legacy of the 2017 tax law changes, where a lot of those tax provisions were temporary and either phased down or expire altogether between now and the end of 2025. And so one that's really important, it's pretty broad, is the phase down of bonus depreciation, which was set at 100% starting in, it was actually in the fourth quarter of 2017 through the end of last year. And it's starting to phase down. It is now at 80% bonus depreciation, with the balance then taken using the depreciation rules under the law outside of bonus. And it will continue to phase down from 80% down to 60% and then 40% going down to zero by the end of 2026. And so that's going to have a slow rolling effect, of course, on folks who have a lot of investment that they're deducting, writing off their tax returns. The second that's worth mentioning that has been a big part of the discussion that I think will continue to be part of the discussion is the tighter limitation on interest deductions, where it's now set at 30% of EBIT rather than EBITDA. And of course, that's also going to, for folks who have debt financed investment, going to be a topic of discussion, something that was folks were trying to lobby to reverse at the end of last year, but it did not get off the ground. Another thing that came to effect last year, but still, I think, going to be, if anything, I think a shift in expectations about where it's headed is the shift from expensing of R&D to amortization. That started last year, but the thought was, hey, that's actually going to be reversed and will be that it won't actually be binding on tax returns that are being filed for last tax year and then for this year. But it looks like it is going to be the case that we're going to be amortizing domestically R&D expenses for 5 years or for 15 years for foreign R&D investment, both for last tax season and for this year. And it's really unclear whether or not that's actually going to be reversed in Congress anytime soon. So that's another one that's going to be important for particular business tax filers and small businesses to take advantage of those provisions.
So let's dig into those real quick. So starting with bonus depreciation, one of the big changes in 2017, not only was it going to 100% bonus depreciation, because it had been at 50, right? Yep. And going to 100, but also going to applying to used property, which is what was the big issue for real estate, because most real estate, of course, that changes hands is used property, not new property. And then to cover everything under 20 years and change some of the years rules, we had the big question on leasehold improvements, which we went back and forth, and eventually that got fixed retroactively. So right now we're in the same rules as we were last year, except we're at 80%, which means the other 20% is under normal depreciation, okay? And this is still just property with useful life under 20 years, right?
That's right.
So when it phases down, so let's talk about that phase down, because I think right now, I think as CPAs, we need to be projecting out for our clients and looking at their investing. So when it phases down, so next year, 2024, it's at 60%. 2025, it's at 40%. And 2026, it's at 20%. In 2027, does it revert back to the original law, which was 50% on new? Is that what it does?
My understanding is it's actually, it goes down to zero. So it's actually worse treatment than it was prior to the 2017 law.
So it doesn't, that's not a 10-year law that then reverses after 10 years, like most of the 2017 Act. This is a 10-year law that actually effectively becomes permanent unless they do something about it.
Exactly. Yeah, because for the most part, the 50% bonus and other bonus provisions in the past were also temporary. So to the extent that wasn't a permanent change yet, it will all revert back to zero at the end of this phase down. And important point for us to notice, both for their clients and the policy side, is it's going to be worse treatment than it was even prior to the law.
Interesting. Okay. So let's switch over to interest, because I think that's one that is very confusing. It's a very confusing rule to begin with. It's so confusing. I had a client that they got audited, and we asked, well, what generated this audit? Well, it was the interest limitation rules. Well, we'd done that exactly right, and they gave us a no change, and yet that's what had precipitated the audit. So even the IRS was confused, clearly, on how their own rules worked. Otherwise, they would have looked at that return and said, well, yeah, they filled out the form right. This looks right. There's no reason to audit this return. Tell us how, if you can you explain a little bit what that rule is and who it applies to, and then what changes for what this really what seems to be a big change. What's this big change in 2023?
Right. So basically, this rule is limiting the value of interest payment, of deducting interest payments on often on debt finance investment for firms. So of course, firms have a choice as to whether or not they invest with equity or from debt. And a big topic of discussion in the policy world, particularly during the 2017 tax law, was how do we think about the tax treatment of debt finance investment. And one way to sort of balance some of those competing policy concerns that get quite wonky was we're going to still allow for deduction for interest payments on debt finance investment, but we're going to put a limitation in effect to help limit that, especially when you combine that with expensing, because there's some questions about whether or not you're subsidizing debt finance investment in that context. And so what they came up with was a fairly complex scheme in which the first few years from 2018 to the end of last year, where you have an interest deduction of up to 30% of your earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. That restriction is a fairly standard from an international perspective limitation. A lot of countries use that limitation to limit the value of interest deductions.
So that I'm clear, let me just pause, make sure, because I've done these computations and yet I still find them confusing. So the limit is, are we limiting to 30% of income, or are we getting a 30% haircut on the interest?
So it's limited to 30% of income, of EBITDA.
Okay, so 30% of EBITDA, which is after depreciation and amortization, which means that it is severely reduced by even depreciation and amortization. Okay, so what's the change then? Now, to be clear, it doesn't apply to small taxpayers, right? $25 million. Mm. And then it doesn't apply to real estate, except for syndications, which has that interesting elect out rule.
Yeah, real estate and I believe finance too. And that's also typically normal.
Say that again.
Real estate and I believe most of finance is also excluded from a lot of that because they have their own, a lot of other rules. That rule can be complicated. It is something I think that was mirrored off of a lot of other countries that use something similar for their limitations. But we then moved from that to something that actually is fairly unusual from an international perspective, which is an even tighter limit, which is moving from 30% of EBITDA to 30% of just earnings before interest and taxes. So just EBIT. So we're dropping the duh, if you will, the depreciation and amortization side of things.
It's early, but doesn't that increase the limit? If it's limited to 30%, and we've increased our income by eliminating depreciation and amortization, that actually increases our income.
I have to think about the math on this, but it is meant to, in terms of the limit, tighten the amount of interest that's actually deducted.
This is where I'm asking the question. Because depreciation and amortization are an expense. They're an expense, which means that you have lower income with them included in the computation, than you have without them included in the computation. So if we're taking them out of the computation, that would actually, and it's 30% of earnings before income and taxes, mm-hmm. but we don't have to deduct depreciation and amortization. Doesn't that raise the amount of interest expense we can take?
Well, yeah. So again, I have to go back, but it's really not meant to. So it's definitely not providing a more generous deduction for sure. So
okay, so we're gonna have to dig into that.
Yeah,
that's something. The point here is for everyone is that we're gonna have to look at those rules in great detail because you may think that you don't that your clients don't qualify for this because they're under the $25 million test. But remember, that's a moving average. That's 3 years. Of and remember also that we have to aggregate controlled entities. So if we have, you know, we have three different businesses and they add up to 25 million, we're still subject to those limitations. So we make sure that we need to aggregate those. And then we need to look at this change. And I'm going to have to look at this because I have not looked at this change myself. And we'll have to look at how does that change in how that 30% is computed impact those clients that are impacted.
That's right. It's also fairly unusual, as I mentioned. So that's the other thing, and that there's not a lot of cross-country or other comparisons to look at to help folks from a sort of what this may mean, you know, for investment incentives and for how folks are planning. So
got it. So let's talk about the R&D for a minute here. So in the past, we've actually had, you know, R&D. I actually have a buddy who was in Washington, D.C. and spent his entire career getting the R&D credit extended. He was a lobbyist and got every year got that R&D credit extended because it's always been temporary, right? The R&D credit. And until 2017, Rich, right? Which made it permanent. And so now we've got something that we thought was going to be the temporary. We were putting a hold on deducting, both getting a deduction and a credit, right? And so now, beginning 2022, we either get the deduction upfront or we take the credit and amortize over 5 years. So what do you see, since you look at policy so much, and there was, you know, I think there's bipartisan support to reverse this, but the Democrats are basically holding a gun to the Republicans and say, yeah, we know this is more important to you, your constituents, than it is to our constituents. At least they think that, even though that's odd because the big tech companies get a lot of R&D credit. The big pharma companies get a lot of R&D credit. They're big Democratic supporters. Do you think this is going to get reversed retroactively? Like we've seen this in the past where we had extenders that we actually got a bill in the subsequent year and made it retroactive all the way back to the beginning of the law.
Right. So that was actually one of, I think, several design considerations that they never got to at the end of last year in the lame duck session, which was the question of how do we extend or reverse this shift from amortization back to full expensing of R&D expenses. And the one question was in the case of R&D, right, it kicked in 2022. Do we go ahead in that year, arguing especially because a lot of firms had expected that this was going to be reversed anyway, making certain decisions in their planning, go ahead and reverse it retroactively. I think it was going to be easier from both a political and a policy perspective to have done that at the end of last year than this year, if anything, just because it's much more explicit that it's a retroactive change. And while there is some precedent in doing so in the extenders discussion, it is something that policymakers sometimes hesitate to do. That said, there was that discussion that never really got off the ground because, of course, it was complicated by demands to make more generous certain credits on the individual side that were politically dicey. So that's basically what complicated this, why it never actually happened in lame duck. But the other question that was never really got to that you have to figure out is, do they make this switch permanent moving forward, which in the scoring process is more expensive than a temporary extension, which they were looking at either 1 year or even just through the end of 25, lining it up with the other individual expirations in the 2017 tax law. Because that's ultimately cheaper, but it comes at the trade-off of then it's sort of like Groundhog Day. We have this discussion all over again in a couple of years about this particular provision that keeps coming up for for being re-extended. At this point, it's just hard to see for this session and this year an opportunity to sort of get this off the ground if there's yet still disagreement about other provisions unrelated to this discussion where there's just not enough political support. So unfortunately, that means it's less likely to be extended in the near future. Though I think our next best shot is by the end of this year. If there's another extenders discussion, we could try again to see if that goes anywhere.
Well, it's a little disconcerting just because, you know, when it comes to research and development tax benefits, we are not the leaders in the world. There are many countries that have much better research and development. Much of Europe has better research and development tax benefits. South Africa has 150% deduction. Mm-hmm. Singapore has actually, for small businesses, a 400% deduction. Yep. I mean, there are much better tax benefits in other countries. So it does seem to weaken the competitiveness from that standpoint. But it does seem like it may be, at least for now, that's how we're going to be preparing the 2022 tax returns. And of course, that's what we're looking at in our mm-hmm. profession right now is 2022. It looks like we're going to have to make that decision and run those numbers. Do we expense or do we take the credit and amortize the deduction over the next 5 years?
Right. And the last thing I mentioned on this too is there were some asks by I think the American Institute of CPAs and others for the Treasury to issue additional guidance on this switch. For the most part, it is probably simpler than some of these other things we're talking about, but there still were some edge cases and question marks in the even in the statute that Treasury actually hasn't commented on yet. So I think we're hoping that to get more of that guidance this year, along with, you know, guidance that they're working on other other things. But that is going to make it, that was something that should come up in some other discussions I was having. I was like, that's actually a good point. There hasn't been any formal regulatory guidance or other information for folks as they're entering into this.
Right. And on top of that, of course, the IRS is going after claims for refund. Right. They're going after it hard. Getting a claim for refund through the IRS is, about as easy as getting a deduction for a syndicated conservation easement. Seriously, that they're pretty much just turning them down right and left. So let's talk about a couple of other things. One that changed actually a couple of years ago, but it continues to have an impact on particularly business owners and real estate investors, and that is the excess business loss deduction. So where we can only offset non-business income by $500,000 of business losses. This has been extended, right, through 2008?
It's either 27 or 28, yeah, and that's right. So
that was part of the Inflation Reduction Act.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So this was an effort in the IRA. They were looking to basically close the revenue gaps they're having late in the process, and this was reintroduced. The idea being, well, this was brought in the 2017 tax law. We'll just keep extending it. I think this is actually the second time it was extended. And so this is something to keep going to. And the way we frame it is a lot of folks may want to expect that it's never really going to expire, because by the time we get to 27, there may yet be something else that folks will use as a revenue source.
It's effectively a minimum tax, right?
Yes.
They took one minimum tax out in 2017 and replaced it with a new minimum tax. That's really all they did.
That's right. Yeah.
It's more comprehensive, minimum tax than the original minimum tax, which is interesting. Okay, so we have the excess business losses. So Shirley, you have, we can't have this program without talking a little bit about the Trump tax returns. First is, how does the Tax Foundation feel about them being released in the first place?
That's a good question. And typically, I mean, historically, we tend not to comment on individual returns. Obviously, this is a situation. It's a little.
This is a policy issue.
Yes. And so when it comes to sort of the decision to release returns, this is, you know, historically, when you look at the precedent, it's not something the IRS or Congress has taken lightly. Obviously, taxpayer privacy, is maybe sacrosanct isn't the right term, but it is taken very seriously. And so the decision to do this really needs to be, there needs to be a pretty strong policy rationale to do that. Obviously, you know, when acquiring the returns, Congress was focusing on the IRS audit program, which started under the Nixon administration. The big idea there being, you know, some people ask, why is this even a thing? The reason why is because before that, the IRS had to decide whether or not they were going to audit a sitting president, which itself is a political decision. So the idea was, we'll make it mandatory, and that'll take the decision out of their hands. But what we found, and I think, you know, part of that, and it was an interesting revelation, was maybe that program wasn't running as well as it could have. But that's actually a separate decision from publicly releasing those returns. And part of that, I think, is actually a separate decision related, partly, of course, in politics, but partly it's a question of, you know, should we require, you know, all presidents and presidential candidates to be transparent on their tax returns? Of course, there is some legislation that has been attempted to try to do that. And there's obviously constitutional questions about that. But I think it is an interesting point about whether or not there's a precedent now being set about the potential politicization of releasing tax returns on a bipartisan basis, right? And this isn't you know, targeting any particular person or party. And so I think that's going to be the question moving forward, is what precedent does it set, if any, and will that be respected by others moving forward when it comes to other folks' tax returns?
Yeah, and of course, Donald Trump's tax returns are a little different from Joe Biden's tax returns. You're not talking about a W-2 and a couple of 1099s, right? You're talking about a very complicated tax return. I've been through it in great detail and you know, done some YouTube video, et cetera, on it. But one of the challenges from a policy standpoint is, you know, Donald Trump isn't in this. His tax return isn't just his tax return. It's all of his business associates and, you know, any businesses. And of course, he's got hundreds of entities and enterprises. And, you know, there's very much a hierarchy, you know, holding companies and subholding companies and so forth. And I find it curious that people think they can derive some information out of this that maybe they can't, just because it's, you have to audit the businesses. You can't, I mean, his personal tax return is almost meaningless when it comes to his, you know, business dealings, that you'd have to go to the business tax returns. And will they require an audit of the business tax returns mm-hmm. of a sitting president, where mm-hmm. he's not the only person that's an owner of those of those businesses? I think that is, to me, it's a slippery slope. It seems like a very slippery slope. And especially when you have, you know, not too long ago, you had ProPublica release 3,000 tax returns. You had the New York Times get Donald Trump's tax returns illegally. And you're going, okay, so where is the privacy with our tax returns? And where is the security on the IRS? Because clearly, has the IRS done anything in looking into ProPublica that you know of?
We know that there has been some, apparently the Inspector General is involved, but there has been no substantive sort of revelation in that investigation. So it has, and that's been to the frustration of a lot of folks on the Hill who want more information on that. So I think that is going to be, you know, as oversight sort of changes a bit this year, that's going to be a topic of discussion. I think it's going to overlap a lot with another main topic, of course, which is the how to think about next steps on the IRS additional resources, which we're expecting that you know, the plan on the additional $80 billion that's been provided sometime in the next month or so. And a big question is going to be, you know, if you're focusing on enforcement, it's also important to be focusing on taxpayer privacy and security if you're going to have any sort of trust in the agency moving forward. And so I think that's going to be, if anything, this magnifies the importance of those discussions as well.
Do you have any crystal ball on that, how they're going to use that $80 billion? Because the Republicans are sure going to be watching over that. Of course, if they ever have a functioning Republican caucus. But that's always a question with so much disagreement among the Republicans among themselves. But how do you see that moving forward?
Yeah, I think two things there. One is, I think there is going to be a lot of focus on, you know, there are a lot of promises, particularly informally by Treasury and the White House, that the enforcement will not have negative consequences for lower income taxpayers, particularly under 400,000. There's going to be a lot of questions about how are you going to determine that? How are you going to maintain that promise and oversight to ensure that they're being held accountable there to that promise? So I think that's going to be important. The second is there's going to be questions about the how is taxpayer services being prioritized relative to this, right? So we are entering into a new tax season. There's still, as of last month, a couple of reports by both GAO and the Inspector General that looks at GAO and the taxpayer advocate. That there still is a backlog of paper returns, and that while the situation has improved a little bit, it's still far from the promises we heard from previous Commissioner Chuck Reddick that they'd be caught up by the end of the year. And so I think that's going to be the other area is, as we slowly move out of the pandemic phase of their operations, how are they thinking about these resources in that context? Because that's going to be important for a lot of folks. We're already seeing that there's going to be a promise to really raise those answered call rates from a low of 10% all the way up to 85% potentially. It's a big promise. And how they perform in this tax season, I think, will also be another area that they'll be looking at early on to see how that's being prioritized.
All right. Well, thank you. Anything else that we might have missed that you see happening 2023?
Yeah. So I think this is mostly for, of course, larger taxpayers, but it's still going to be important for them, for CPAs working with them. And, of course, in the policy discussion, which is we are expecting to get a lot more guidance on the Inflation Reduction Act tax increases, the minimum book tax, the stock buyback excise tax, some of these other things that it sounds like Treasury is having a hard time dealing with the details on. We did get some initial guidance late last month on this. We're expecting a lot more. So we'll be covering that at Tax Foundation, and I'm sure it'll be something y'all will follow as well.
So one piece of good news is the increase to the solar tax credit and and then the expansion of the it's both an expansion and a contraction of the electric vehicle tax credit. One thing that came up, which I think is an interesting point, and I want to get your feedback on this. You know, they put in this exception for fleets, which seems to make you believe that if you lease an electric vehicle, you're going to get that credit. Whereas if you buy it, you're not. So that would be another reason. Of course, the depreciation deduction is another reason to lease a vehicle because you get the lease deduction, which is as general rule on a expensive car is way more generous than the depreciation deduction. So any thoughts on those new solar or EV credits?
Yeah, I think overall what you're seeing is Treasury trying to balance a lot of this is coming from, of course, demands for producers of vehicles and components from other countries that may be locked out of this because of the both sourcing rules and produced and assembled in America rules or in the free trade zone that come along with this legislation. So we saw some potential increase in accessibility for those from the fleet and leasing side of things. The other thing that we're watching closely, we don't have details on, but might be important in some of the Treasury details is they may take a fairly expansive view on what counts as a sort of free trade agreement with the US, which unlocks some at least partial credits. They weren't very specific on the initial guidance, but it may be expansive enough to include, for example, production in the European Union, which we don't have at this point a formal free trade agreement with. So we'll be watching that too, because that may slowly increase sort of the, if not the full thing, right, at least part of these credits for folks who are looking to take advantage.
Interesting. Well, thank you, Garrett Watson. Thanks to the Tax Foundation for being our watchdogs over the tax policy up on the Hill. And remember that, when we have these changes, these are also opportunities. These are opportunities to better serve our clients. It's an opportunity to kind of project out to make sure that they understand what's going on and that they understand that there are still lots of tax incentives out there, lots of incentives to help our entrepreneur taxpayers and our investor taxpayers. And when we do that, of course, we end up with better clients because they're much happier about what our services are. We end up with a better practice and, of course, a better life. We'll see y'all next time.
You've been listening to the Wealthability for CPA show. Better clients, better practice, better life. To learn more, go to wealthability.com. This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.